Hello, this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from Glamour Magazine's January and December combination issue. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The truth about winter weight gain. It's not just what you're eating. Research shows that your body wants you to gain weight this time of the year. So how can you outsmart it? The eggnog, the pecan pie, the fast food at the airport. Holiday splurges aren't the only reason many women put on a few pounds every winter. Your body regulates hormones and fat storage differently in the winter than it does in the spring or summer, says Sassoon Malavia, MD, a.k.a. Dr. Sass, the medical director of the Smart for Life Weight Management Center in Florida. Here, how your biology can conspire against you and how to fight back. You're overstressed. Due to everything from holiday demands to the weather's effect on your commute, winter months often cause more stress. The longer you have high levels of the stress hormone cortisol, the more it can exert its nasty effects, increase in appetite and stubborn belly fat. Your fix? 8 hours of sleep and regular workouts will help keep those levels steady. During the winter, you have more cravings. Levels of serotonin, a brain chemical that regulates appetite and mood, may drop in the winter, and that can trigger cravings, especially for carbs. Your fix? A full-spectrum light bulb. Believe it or not, since the darkness of winter may be the reason serotonin levels drop, you can get one for less than $10, and they can fit into any lamp. To make up for the shorter winter days, turn on one for a couple of hours during the evening to trick your body into thinking there are longer daylight hours. It's cold out. The temperature may do funky things to your levels of hormone leptin, a weight regulator, one small study found. The result? Your body mistakenly thinks you're starving and produces appetite-stimulating hormones, so you eat more. Your fix? Snack on protein-rich foods like almonds or have a cup of fiber-rich oatmeal for breakfast to keep leptin on the level. And if you do gain weight, don't despair. Many women naturally shed their winter pounds when they revert to their warm weather eating. Another health article. This one is a question and answer. Health answers, please, from Dr. Joanne Manson. The question, I'm only 21, but I have awful back pains. Is it how I sleep or sit? The answer, I doubt it. Poor ergonomics rarely causes severe pain in someone your age. And when they do, it tends to hurt mainly when you lie or sit in that position. If there are no symptoms, such as a fever, it's probably a sprained muscle. You may have injured yourself, even if you don't remember doing it. Treatment may call for just acetaminophen and rest, but I want to see a doctor. Why? I'm pretty healthy, asked the reader. Women need to take mysterious back pain seriously, since intense pain could be pelvic inflammatory disease, infection of the fallopian tubes or uterus, endometriosis, or a ruptured ovarian cyst. If the pain is new and severe, and you are experiencing lightheadedness or fever, go get help ASAP. Our next article is called How to Haggle for Everything. Yes, it's possible to pay less for cable, a new couch, even a doctor's bill. Glamour Money columnist Carmen Wong Urich, author of the new book, The Real Cost of Living, explains. Your cable and phone bills. True story. I just cut my cell phone bill by $100 a month. Which got to me thinking about how we can all pay less for everyday expenses. Let's start with phone and cable. Check out billshrink.com. That's billshrink.com. And also lowermybills.com to see what other companies are charging. Then call your provider. Ask for the customer retention department. It's their job to keep your business and request a lower rate. Don't be too aggressive. Never bark that you deserve, say, free HBO. Instead, try, do you have any offers or promotions? And you may get your next Big Love fix free. The interest rate on your credit card. If you're one of those savvy girls who never carry a balance, bravo. If not, listen up. The average yearly interest rate fluctuates, and it recently jumped from 11% to 14%. But you may be eligible for a lower one if you have great credit. Find out what the competition is offering at sites like lowcards.com and bankrate.com, and then call your issuer and suggest you'll be transferring your balance. They should play ball. Just beware, some companies offer interest rebates, refunding you a portion of the interest charges for the month if you meet a monthly spending minimum. But those offers could entice you to spend more. Stick to low fixed rate cards and say no to gimmicks. A new car. Sad truth, we arm wrestle over a theory skirt at a sample sale, but sit us down with the car salesman and we go, come on, ladies. If dealerships intimidate you, you just take your haggling online. Sites like KBB.com and AutoTrader.com let you email dealers directly for a quote so you can get them to compete for your business. But you don't have to borrow where you buy. Shop around for your loan, too. Try eloan.com or a credit union and steer clear of dealers who mark up interest rates, especially if you have good credit. If you can't get a set of wheels that you and your wallet love, keep looking. There are plenty of cars out there. Furniture and appliances. I know you need that espresso machine, so get it cheap. The best place to start haggling is at the store. Floor models get bumped around, sat on, and fiddled with, and are often marked down as much as 20%. Top that discount with models that are on sale already, and you could get a costly item for about half its original price. The best months to shop are July, early August, and January, when retailers need to make room for new merchandise. Just be sure your big prize still comes with a warranty. An airline upgrade. This can be a toughie if you're not a frequent flyer, as airlines are running closer to capacity these days, but upgrades still happen. You have a better chance for a free upgrade if you're flying solo or if you casually drop that you're traveling for a wedding. If a flight is oversold, as they often are during the holidays, you can offer to take a later one in exchange for a plush seat and extra legroom. Smile at the gate attendant, the most underused bargaining trick. Charm your fellow passengers, too. My girlfriend got upgraded by chatting up the guy sitting next to her at the gate. He was a ununiformed flight attendant. Your doctor's bill. Believe it or not, you can bargain with your doctor. Many have pay scales that vary depending on a patient's insurance coverage. Find the going rates for common procedures and exams at outofpocket.com. That's outofpocket.com, and ask what your options are when making your appointment. Offering to pay in cash will net you the best discount. But if it's a big bill and you plan to fork over your credit card, request an itemized invoice by mail instead of paying on the spot. Then comb it for errors. As for therapy, if you're going out of network and the cost is a hardship, your shrink may shrink her fees if asked, and you could walk out a happy, emotionally and financially happy person. Our next article is called, I Was Kidnapped at Age 4. Pepper Smith remembers the day she was stolen from her parents and the abuse and loneliness that came afterwards. In this Glamour exclusive, she tells the dramatic story of her 30-year search to find her family and the startling discoveries that changed everything. Once upon a time, I was Wanda Patricia Christie, a beloved 4-year-old princess living with my parents in a tiny garden apartment near the naval base in San Diego. Mom, in her beehive hairdo, would dress me up in frilly purple dresses to meet Dad's ship whenever he came into port, and he would spend his shore leave teaching me to ride a bike. "You'll start school soon like a big girl," Mom would tell me, and I couldn't wait to be in school with other kids my age. It was a happy, sunny time. I had no idea that dark secrets were swirling around my family, secrets that would swallow my childhood. One afternoon, there came a knock at the door, and when Mom opened it, there was a lady I'd never seen before. Next to her stood a tall girl, a little older than me. Mom seemed to know the woman. She called her Shirley. And that surprised me because I didn't think Mom would be friends with somebody who was missing teeth. They told me that the tall girl, Renee, was my sister. She didn't look like me. Her skin was much darker. But I was so happy to have a sister, I didn't ask questions. Mom told me I was going to have a fun sleepover. Renee would play with us for a while, and then I'd spend the night with them at their hotel. When she saw my bedroom, Renee acted oddly. Later, I realized it was because she had never seen such things, like a canopy bed, a closet full of dresses, toys. "This is all yours?" I remember her asking. Then Mom dressed me in my favorite red sneakers, packed me an overnight bag, and kissed me on the cheek, told me to be good and have fun. "I'll see you tomorrow," she sang. As we drove off, Mom stood in the street and waved. I didn't see her again for 30 years. Shirley drove us to an ugly motel, but we didn't stay there. She rushed us up to a room, barking at me to hurry up, and threw a few belongings into the car. We drove off with a squeal of the tires. I said, "I want my mom." Shirley turned in her seat and screamed in my face, "Pepper, you shut up." Nobody had ever yelled at me, so I didn't know the name Pepper. I started to cry. Shirley snarled at Renee, "You keep that little chink quiet." And that began my new life. The next 12 years were a blur of cheap motels where we'd stay a day or two before sneaking out in the middle of the night. Pepper, Shirley called me, never Rhonda. I had no idea why she renamed me, and I learned quickly not to insist I was Rhonda. All that got me was a nasty scolding. I was hungry and dirty. Shirley never cooked. She'd take us to the Salvation Army soup kitchens for bowls of mush, and Renee and I would scrounge for food, and sometimes I begged for handouts. For money, Shirley would drive out to highway rest areas and visit truckers in their cabs for 15 minutes. Not until I was older did I figure that one out. Some nights, Renee and I slept in rest stop restrooms. Shirley kept saying that Renee and I were sisters, but I never understood that. She looked nothing like me, and why had I not known about her? I kept waiting for the nightmare to end, for Mom to show up and take me home. But it went on and on. The hunger, discomfort, and fears were terrible. But the worst part was, who was Shirley, and why was she mean to me? And why had my mother let her take me? I cried for my mother a lot, and Shirley would snarl that she was protecting me from that effer. She would never tell me what my mom had done to make her hate her. Shirley warned me to never talk to anybody, especially the peace, because we'd go straight to prison. I never understood why, but she said it was such anger, I was afraid to doubt her. More than once, the police pulled us over. Renee often panicked and screamed and cried, so that the officer would ask what was wrong. And Shirley had a story. I'm the grandmother, looking after them now. Their parents were killed in a car crash. I wanted to shout, no, they weren't. But by then, I had become traumatized, and I was just a puppet. Through my teary eyes, I would watch him drive off. I still dreamed of going to school like other kids, but we never stayed long enough anywhere. Two nights here, a week there, always in awful hotels full of drunks and addicts. Every now and then, we drive in Shirley's old car cross country to New Orleans, where somebody called T.T. lived. There were three boys always in and out of her house, and they hated me and Renee. Renee is black, and they seemed to think I was Asian. They called me the ugliest names, and worse, one of the boys was all over me. We'd never stay at T.T.'s long before we'd get back on the road, but being molested became a regular feature of my life. I remember one old guy. I must have been 6 years old, and every few months we'd circle back to T.T. and those horrible boys. As the years went on, it got harder and harder for me to remember my mom's face. I used to have the memory of her. I had snapshot memories and a dim recollection of my parents, Bob and Shirley. That I was not to go into, but when she was asleep, I would sometimes take a peek. She kept a photograph in there that I'd seen before, me and my mom dressed up to meet my dad's ship, holding hands. Only Shirley had cut the picture in half, throwing away the image of me. In retrospect, it was a perfect metaphor for my childhood. I was gone. What drove Shirley? I never knew, and I still don't. She hated my mother, that was clear, but enough to drag me around for years? I can almost understand kidnapping a child because you love her, but why kidnap a child you hate? She put me in school a couple of times, a month here, a month there. Then she told me to call myself Rhonda. But by that time, I had been Pepper for so long, I wouldn't answer to Rhonda, and people thought I was stupid. I couldn't read or write and refused to speak. I'd become a listener, though. Shirley would be talking to her friends in some motel and say, "Don't worry about her. She's asleep, and she don't talk. She won't tell anyone what's going on." She was right. I wouldn't talk. She had me thoroughly terrorized. But she was wrong that I wasn't listening. What saved me through all those years was that I always knew that what she did was wrong, and what she was doing to me was wrong. Walking back to the motel from school, I'd look at houses with clean, happy children out front. I had known love, and while the details were fading, and that feeling of having been loved never left me. I believed Renee had never known anything like that, so she didn't know what was happening to us was wrong. Her way of dealing was to sleep all the time. I didn't sleep. I stayed awake. I listened. I remembered things. But what I cannot understand is why nobody ever suspected something was going on. Kids show up at school with no notice and leave a month later, and then return a following year. That doesn't put up a red flag. And it wasn't just me and Renee who were being mistreated. Every sleazy motel we stayed at were full of what I call motel kids. Children dragged around by abusive, addicted adults. When I was in fifth grade, a couple of drunken grown-ups left their three-month-old baby with me. I fed him sugar water because I didn't know any better. We had a playpen in the motel room, and I slept in it with him. I had that baby a whole year, and then the parents showed up and took him back. Kids like that, like me, are invisible. I guess because Renee and I spent more than a decade being dragged around, hardly going to grade school, nobody ever called the police or Child Protective Services. Nobody. I knew very few decent people. One boy was a sweet-natured motel kid my own age who suddenly disappeared from my life as we were becoming friends. Another was a prostitute I met at a motel in California where we lived on and off. She gave me the first hug I had in years. I wanted to go on and on. And then there was a woman who worked at one of the motels. She spoke almost no English, but called me baby mama because I always had a baby on my hip. She fed and bathed me. She even took me to Indian festivals with her family. But as far as I know, she never called the police. Maybe she was afraid to. I think she just didn't realize. I didn't see her leave the motel. She may not have even been legally in this country. Perhaps for her, that scene of a motel, filthy, neglected children, abusive parents, was normal in America. I'd like to say that I ran away at 12, but ran away implies someone wanted me to stay. Truthfully, by then, Shirley didn't care what I did. I've been taking care of another baby, a 9-month-old. Her parents used to tie her to the potty, and they'd whip her tiny brother with a belt. When they left the motel, I went with them to protect her and to get away from Shirley, and got through a whole semester of 7th grade. But it was worse with them than at the motel. The drinking and the screaming were terrible. The dad even shot up the house one night with a gun. Finally, I could tell he was getting sexually interested in me, so I took off. That was the start of my third phase of life, drifting around on my own. I would stay with whoever would take me in, make my way in school, to school in the mornings, and get odd jobs I could find. School was the one constant in my life. Occasionally, I'd ask the county for food stamps, but I could never get help because I couldn't prove who I was. When I tried to explain my circumstances, social workers would say, "I can't help you." When I was 16, I got hauled before a judge for driving without a license. When I told him my whole story, he dismissed me to pay a fine. I never heard of such a thing. People who might have helped me didn't believe my story. For years, life continued to be a challenge, and money wasn't a problem. Then in 2009, a woman at my church offered to adopt me as an adult. But it was no joke. If she legally adopted me, I could get a birth certificate, I could go to college, get a job. We filed the paperwork using the name I knew, Rhonda Pepper Smith, and miraculously, a judge approved it. But then the county halls of records put a stop on it because in the boxes for name of my birth parents, we wrote unknown. The woman at the halls of records who called me, I wish her knew her name, was heartbroken. But the department sent back my paperwork. But when I opened the envelope, I found among my papers a photocopy of a California birth certificate, Rhonda Patricia Christie. The birth date was mine. The parents, Robert Christie and Barbara Christie. I almost passed out. With that information, I was able to track them down in Ohio. When I reached for the phone to dial their number, my hand was shaking. "Hello," said a man. "Are you married to Barbara?" I asked. "I am. Do you know anything about Rhonda Patricia Christie?" There was a long pause. Then I said, "I think I'm her." "Barbara," he yelled, "pick up the phone. It's Rhonda." I'm still putting together the pieces of my identity. I finally learned to my shock that Bob and Bobby are my adoptive parents. They told me I'd actually been born to a New Orleans couple who gave me up for adoption. Mom took me in when I was 3 months old, but it was not my birth mother who arrived to deliver me to her. It was Shirley, the name Shirley. My adoption was finalized when I was 4. Sometime after that, Shirley showed up again with Renee, who I'm told really is my half-sister. I had actually first met her when I was a toddler, but I had no memory of that. "When Shirley took you off, I had a feeling," Mom told me. "The next day we drove to where you were supposed to be, but the motel was vacant, and we knew you were gone. My heart died," she told me. She then told me they called the police in California, but nobody took them seriously because they had willingly given me to Shirley. It turns out my parents knew that horrible TT in New Orleans, and they drove all night to her house, stopping at rest areas. Titi told them nothing, but lying there on her porch were my red sneakers. My father went so ballistic that a cop on the scene had to restrain him. But the police still couldn't help them get the answers they needed. They wouldn't help them find me. It's infuriating to me that police didn't take my kidnapping more seriously. My parents weren't rich or sophisticated, and their relationship to Shirley muddied the situation. I imagine the case was easy to ignore, but a maddening list of much bigger questions remained. How did my parents know Shirley and TT? Was Shirley able to deliver me as an infant to my mom? Why did Shirley hate my mother? And why, oh why, did my mother hand me over to Shirley that day? When I ask these questions, my parents become vague. I can see the agony in their faces, and I don't press them too hard. They're old. Mom is sick. The secrets they are keeping are painful. I may never get the answers. I can live with it. I have survived by refusing to let Shirley's memory keep me her prisoner. What's important is the present, the family I've built, my dear and everlasting friends. I still struggle. Holidays are hard. Everyone brings up their rosy childhood memories, and I sit mute. Even meeting people and starting romantic relationships is difficult. One of the first questions they ask, where are you from? That's a question I can't answer. Mom and Dad would love if I moved to Upper Sandusky where they live, but I'm staying put. I've been able to get financial aid now that I'm a student at Humboldt University in California. I talk to Mom and Dad often, and we visit several times. Culturally, we are very different, but that love is still there. Much as I want them to clear up all the dark mysteries of my childhood, I draw every day on the 4 years of love and decency they gave me to start my life. It protected me from the horrors of what came later and protects me still. I'm free now. Shirley, it turns out, didn't win after all. Haiti, 1 year later, 12 months after the earthquake that killed more than 200,000 people and devastated a country, young women continue to make a difference. For example, Heather Lorenzo. When Lorenzo, a nurse practitioner, volunteered in Haiti with the International Medical Corps, learned last summer that four girls, one of them barely 12 years old, had been raped within 1 week in the camp for the displaced, she spun into action. Lorenzo gathered camp managers, police, UN officials, and anyone else with the power to help. Within days, she had lights installed. So many of the mechanisms that protect women, locks, doors, shelters, have been destroyed. She now oversees anti-violence workshops for men and women. How you can help? Follow the International Medical Corps on Facebook and Twitter. Giving a gift is an incredible way to help, but sometimes it's about staying informed, too. Regine Zamore. 3 days after the quake, Zamore, a New York-born to Haitian parents, arrived in Port-au-Prince. The producer, whose film Children of Haiti about Haitian street kids, premieres this month. She arranged food and water to go into areas that most people find too dangerous. Sasha Kramer. Haiti has poor sanitation, and much of the land is too eroded to support crops. Kramer co-founded Soil, Sustainable Organic Integrated Livelihoods, to create toilets that would repurpose human waste as fertilizer. After the quake, she installed latrines in some of the tent cities in Port-au-Prince, where more than 1 million people still live. How can you help? At press time, cholera spread when waste-contaminated drinking water was threatening the capital. To help Kramer, visit oursoil.org. Christina Newman and Cameron Verano. Newman first came to Haiti in 2007 as an agricultural grad working with nuns who showed her egg facilities. Can you duplicate this? The nuns ask. Because meat is costly, children suffer from stunted development from lack of protein. So Newman and her friend Verano hatched an organization they called Hens for Haiti to produce protein-rich foods and provide jobs. They broke ground in August. The earthquake showed how badly Haiti needs industry, says Newman. How you can help? Volunteer, educate yourself, and give. Or go to Hens for Haiti, that's hensforhaiti.org.vt.edu, to help with the Hens for Haiti project. Six things that pros agree on. Number one, don't smoke. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of From Soups to Nuts. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long, until next time.